Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today, we're doing something a bit different. We're moving from those broad analyses to focus on a really personal story.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, it's a 20-year career in the United States Air Force, told firsthand. It's from a YouTube video, episode 69 from Airman to Captain, my 20-year Air Force journey on the Military Tales channel.
Right. I think I saw that one. What's really valuable there, I think, is getting that individual perspective, the lived experience. It often gets kind of lost in the official histories.
Exactly. It lets you see the Air Force not just as this huge institution, but, well, as a collection of individual journeys, full of unexpected twists and turns.
Yeah, the human side of it.
Totally. It's not just a list of ranks and where someone was stationed. It's about the people, the specific places, the events that really shape this one person's service.
And the time period is interesting too, right? Spanning from the draft era into the late 20th century gives it a historical angle.
It does. So, okay, let's dive in. The man telling his story, Jim Hoover, he starts with why he joined the Air Force in the first place.
Yeah.
And it wasn't like a lifelong dream or anything.
Right. He's pretty upfront about it. He says he was looking to avoid the army draft.
Which makes sense for the time.
Yeah, that was a huge factor for a lot of young guys then. And it's interesting, how that initial reason maybe shaped his whole career path in the Air Force.
He did mention some interest, though. His uncle had served, and he watched that Air Power TV series.
True. So even pragmatic choices can have those personal connections behind them.
So he joins up, has a college degree, but his first assignment after basic, security policeman at Vandenberg Air Force Base.
Yeah, that seems a bit counterintuitive, maybe, given the degree.
Right.
It kind of makes you wonder about how the military assigns people, How unpredictable those first roles can be. He even mentioned feeling like maybe some technical training would have been good, despite the degree.
Yeah, like the academic side doesn't always map directly onto the specific job skills needed right away.
Exactly.
But Vandenberg wasn't just about patrols and security stuff. It's actually where something pretty major happened in his personal life. It involves a motorcycle accident.
Oh,
Not his, I hope.
no, a friend's. A staff sergeant friend was laid up in the hospital after a motorcycle crash.
God.
And this friend apparently decided to play matchmaker.
Ah, I see where this is going.
Yeah, he introduced Jim to one of the nurses who happened to be a first lieutenant.
Wow. A bit of hospital romance orchestrated by the injured friend. That's brilliant.
And get this, they've now been married for 53 years.
No kidding. 53 years. That's incredible. This
Yeah.
goes to show, right? The big moments happen in the strangest ways sometimes.
Talk about a lucky break, literally for the friend, maybe figuratively for Jim. So soon after they got married, Jim gets reassigned to Nam Phnom, Thailand.
Okay, Thailand. That's a big change.
Yeah, he calls it the place where the real adventure began, says it was a time of huge personal growth for him.
And a significant place strategically back then, during the Vietnam War. Thailand's was a key base for U.S. operations. Definitely. So his first duties there were on BF flight swing shift.
Swing shift, so afternoons and evenings, typically.
Right. Doing perimeter patrols, transporting the Thai guards who worked on base. He even mentions the food. You know, the difference between what the Thai guards ate, sticky rice, and the food at the American Chow Hall, the Sky Raider Chow Hall.
Small details, but they really tell you something, don't they? About the daily life, the cultural mix on the base. Those local guards were essential.
Absolutely. He also worked at the base jail, they called it correctional custody, and did other law enforcement stuff. But interestingly, he said they were sometimes a bit lenient with guys caught out in town after curfew.
Really? Like a bit of unofficial understanding.
Maybe. Perhaps just acknowledging that people needed to blow off steam, even with the rules. It shows that, things weren't always completely rigid.
A human touch within the system, yeah.
One of the really vivid parts he talks about is the TII checkpoint. Doesn't define it exactly, but sounds like a main entry point or something. He describes seeing the cardboard village just outside, and the locals seemed friendly, even though they knew Viet Cong were active in the area.
Wow. That really brings home the tension of being stationed there. The lines must have been so blurry between civilians and potential threats. Cardboard village. Probably just makeshift housing,
Yeah,
right?
likely. Stuff that springs up near bases. But then there's this story about a snake.
Oh boy, in Thailand. I bet it was a memorable one.
Definitely. It was in a gully near some construction workers. And the reaction of the Thai workers, they started shouting, "Dum Li," which he thought meant policeman. So he went over.
Okay. Makes sense.
But then the base vet shows up, identifies the snake. Turns out it was a two-step viper.
A two-step viper. Whoa. Okay, that name tells you everything you need to know. A serious reminder of the non-combat dangers there.
No kidding. He also guarded the hooches, the living quarters for officers, pilots, and also a general butcher who ran Task Force Alpha, though Jim didn't know who the general was at first.
Right, typical military hierarchy. A junior guy wouldn't necessarily know all the top brass right away, but that connection becomes important later, right?
It does. He also mentioned doing his foot patrols. He'd sometimes chat with pilots at the squadron bar, hear their flying stories.
Ah, the bar conversations.
Yeah, and he admits later he kind of regretted not trying to become a pilot himself.
You hear that sometimes, the what ifs. It shows that camaraderie, though, across different roles.
Very much so. But there's a really moving story he tells about carrying the flag at a memorial service.
Yeah, wow.
For a pilot shot down over Laos, he remembers the guy so clearly, flat top, haircut, buck teeth. Even remembers the pilot had a pet snake named Georgia.
A pet snake, Georgia, that's specific. But remembering those details, it really shows the impact, the human cost.
Absolutely. And there's this bizarre little anecdote attached. Apparently, after the pilot died, Georgia the snake somehow got loose and ended up crawling into a Green Beret's bed.
You're kidding? A snake in the bed? That's darkly humorous, I guess, in a really strange way.
Yeah, definitely memorable. He also mentions an unsuccessful search and rescue for a lost first lieutenant. Just another grim reminder of the risks, even not in direct combat.
Right. Flying itself had dangers. Those missions, the searches... Sometimes they just couldn't bring everyone back. It's heartbreaking.
So back to General Butcher. Jim has this, like, totally accidental meeting with him while guarding his trailer one night.
The Task Force Alpha guy.
Yeah. And they end up talking, but not about war strategy or anything. They talked about construction equipment.
Construction equipment. Seriously.
Yeah. The general saw Jim looking at some plans or something. It just shows, you know, even high-ranking officers have other interests.
A human side, yeah. Breaks the stereotype a bit.
And it was through these chats that Jim actually learned what Task Force Alpha was all about, this major intelligence operation.
Right, using sensors dropped along trails and computers to analyze the data.
Exactly. Early tech for tracking enemy movement. He even mentioned how things changed when the enemy switched from using trucks more to using bicycles and how that affected the sensors.
Fascinating. Shows that constant cat and mouse game of intelligence and countermeasures, adapting to what the enemy does.
Then, in a complete shift, Jim ends up working in the orderly room, the admin office.
How did that happen? From security police?
Totally by chance. He helped out a master sergeant who was struggling to type up an airman performance report, an APR. Jim could type well.
Ah, the hidden skills, and they snapped him up.
Pretty much.
Yeah.
Suddenly, he's spending hours typing up APRs and award decorations. Unintended consequences of being helpful, I guess.
Ah. Yeah, be careful what skills you reveal. But it obviously led somewhere.
It did. That experience, his typing skills, it led to him getting transferred to office work back in the States. And eventually, he became the base commander's chief clerk.
Wow, quite a climb. Shows how you can move around and find different niches in the military based on demonstrated competence.
And his success there didn't go unnoticed. He got recommended for officer training school, OTS.
So he went from enlisted to officer, airman basic, eventually up to staff sergeant, then commissioned as a second lieutenant.
Yep. Remarkable progression.
Yeah.
Shows what was possible.
Definitely. A testament to his abilities.
His first officer gig was with the 9th Air Force IG Inspector General's office.
Okay. So investigations, compliance, that sort of thing.
Right. Then another big move, Mildenhall, England. And this is where things get really intriguing.
Mildenhall? That housed some interesting assets, didn't it?
It sure did. Mm-hmm. He got involved with, as he puts it, a spy network and operations related to the SR-71 Blackbird.
The SR-71. Wow. Okay, now we're talking serious Cold War stuff.
Absolutely. He said he worked with something like 28 different spy agencies, and his job involved hand-carrying highly sensitive materials.
Hand-carrying, like physical documents.
Yeah, including messages between President Carter and the British Prime Minister Callaghan, and also to the NATO commander, General Rogers.
Incredible. Physically moving messages between world leaders. That speaks volumes about the trust they placed in him and the security needs before secure digital comms were widespread.
Straight out of a spy novel, right?
Totally.
After England, he went to Edwards Air Force Base in California, working at the Rocket Propulsion Lab.
Edwards AFB. Right. Cutting-edge flight testing, rocketry.
Yeah, he was working with the scientists there, serving as the personnel, admin, and protocol officer. Later on, he actually commanded the headquarters squadron at Edwards.
commanding the HQ squadron. So he'd have oversight over admin, support, even potentially personnel technically assigned to the base general staff in that context.
Seems like it. Complex military structure stuff.
Yeah, definitely. Shows the variety of leadership roles.
He also ran two combined federal campaigns, those are big charity drives on base. Mm. And then he decided he wanted another change. He requested retraining in contracting.
Contracting. Interesting shift again. Why contracting?
He doesn't elaborate much, but it led him to work on contracts for rocket propulsion and also classified projects. He hints they might have been part of the Star Wars Initiative, SDI.
Ah, Strategic Defense Initiative. Right. High-tech, highly classified work in the 80s. Makes sense for Edwards. He clearly wasn't afraid to learn new things.
Not at all. And that contracting path led to a really unique assignment later at Pratt & Whitney, the aircraft engine manufacturer.
Oh, interesting. Working on the industry side, but still as military personnel.
Exactly. He was overseeing engine procurement for the military. Think F-14s, F-18s for the Navy, F-16s, F-15s for the Air Force.
Major programs, huge responsibility.
And also the engine for the presidential aircraft, Air Force One.
Wow.
And he tells this story about finding the presidential engine just sitting there, basically unsecured in the facility.
You're kidding. The engine for Air Force One, unsecured.
Apparently so. He brought it up directly with the company president.
Good for him. Takes guts, but absolutely the right thing to do. Shows that security mindset never really left him.
Definitely stuck with him. So after 20 years, he retired from the Air Force as a captain, but he didn't stop working.
No. What did he do then?
He worked for another 13 years as a contract administrator, but this time as a civilian in the aerospace industry. Makes sense, given his last assignment.
Yeah, a natural transition, leveraging that experience.
But he'd ended up taking early retirement from that job because of heart trouble. And he suspects it might be connected to Agent Orange exposure back in Nam Phenom.
Agent Orange. That comes up so often with Vietnam-era vets, especially those stationed in Thailand, too. The long-term health consequences.
He talks about it directly, says he saw large quantities of it being transported to the base, and he was assigned at one point to guard C-123 aircraft.
The C-123s? Yeah, those were heavily used in Operation Ranch Hand, the defoliation missions. Even if you wasn't flying, just being around those planes or where the herbicide was stored or handled.
Exactly. It's a potential link. It highlights those unseen risks, the possible exposures that weren't fully understood or acknowledged at the time.
Mm-hmm.
He also mentioned raising a security concern back then about the thick jungle foliage right up against the base perimeter at Nam Phenom.
Worried about cover for infiltration.
Yeah. He thought it was a major vulnerability. He raised it up the chain, apparently all the way to Captain Brady, who was his boss. And eventually Admiral Zumwalt made the decision to clear it.
Wow. So his observation actually led to a significant change. Shows the importance of people on the ground speaking up.
It really does. He also tells this really unsettling story about black market activity there.
Oh, yeah. What kind?
He describes Thai women collecting discarded aluminum cans from the officers' club, the NCO club, even the hooches.
Okay. Recycling or...
Not exactly. They were smuggling these cans, he says, across the border into Laos, and eventually they ended up in North Vietnam, where they were apparently being melted down and used to make parts for bombs or munitions.
Get out! Aluminum cans from the U.S. base being used against U.S. forces.
That's what he recounts. Mm. It's a really stark example of the weird, unintended consequences in a war zone. How everyday items could be repurposed in such a dangerous way.
It's mind-blowing, actually. The sheer resourcefulness, but also the chilling reality of it.
He also gives some geographical context. Nam Phenom City wasn't right on the base, and across the Mekong River was Thakit, Laos, which he says was a known R&R spot for the Viet Cong.
So the enemy was literally right across the river.
Pretty much. He talks about the ways they tried to infiltrate the base, the constant need for vigilance, especially guarding the fuel dumps, POL, petroleum, oil, lubricants, and the ammo storage areas.
Yeah, hitting those would be catastrophic. Huge targets. The pressure must have been immense.
Constant pressure. So near the end of the video, he's asked if he'd recommend military service today.
And what does he say after all that?
It's interesting. He gives a kind of yes and no answer. He values his own experience, definitely. But he feels like maybe the camaraderie isn't quite the same now. Mm. And that political dynamics sometimes get in the way of teamwork more than they used to.
Hmm. That's a thoughtful perspective. Acknowledging the positives he experienced, but also seeing potential changes in the environment today. It's not a simple yes or no question, really.
No, it's not. And finally, he shares something deeply personal. a spiritual experience he had in the base chapel back in Thailand in 1970.
Oh, wow.
And also a near-death experience he had later in life. He described seeing a white cone, a black coil, a dark triangular tunnel, seeing a light, hearing music. Very vivid imagery.
That's intense. It adds another layer entirely, doesn't it? Beyond the military service, these profound, personal, almost mystical experiences.
Yeah, it really rounds out the story, showing the person behind the uniform and the career.
Absolutely.
So Jim Hoover's 20-year journey, I mean, it really covers a lot of ground, doesn't it? From the mundane daily tasks to some really extraordinary high-stakes situations.
It absolutely does. What really stands out is getting that personal window into what military life was actually like over those two decades. You see the Cold War, the Vietnam conflict, not as headlines, but as lived reality for one person.
Yeah, the human story within the big machine.
Exactly. It's a great reminder that behind all the history, behind the ranks and the missions, there are these unique individual stories, and they all have lasting impacts, both on the person and, you know, collectively.
So thinking about Jim's whole journey, it really makes you consider the long-term effects of service, doesn't it? And just how unpredictable a career path can be.
It really does.
It definitely pushes you to look past the sort of official narratives and think about the individual experiences that make up that larger history. What stories aren't we always hearing?